And I supported this bill. I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots and who have lived here, even though sometime back they may have entered illegally. With regard to the employer sanctions, we must have that, not only to ensure that we can identify the illegal aliens, but also, while some keep protesting about what it would do to employers, there is another employer that we shouldn't be so concerned about. And these are employers down through the years who have encouraged the illegal entry into this country, because they then hire these individuals and hire them at starvation wages and with none of the benefits that we think are normal and natural for workers in our country. And the individuals can't complain because of their illegal status. We don't think that those people should be allowed to continue operating free. And this was why the provisions that we had in with regard to sanctions and so forth.
Well, there's blue-collar workers that earn more than college students. So there really is no embarrassment or shame in being a blue-collar worker. In fact, my grandfather, even though he was from Wales, he was a blue-collar worker. So there's nothing wrong with the skill. But I do want to go back to the construction industry where illegal aliens are working. Well, first, a legal alien is not entitled to be working. And second, a lot of the times they're using somebody else's identity or social security cards.
Hey guys, we'll get into the podcast in just a minute. However, I am looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show, and I am planning a road trip across America and including parts of Canada. I'll tell you more about both of these at the end of this podcast. Well, hello, guys, and welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show. Today, we have an interesting guest, Lorraine Woodwark. Lorraine is an attorney specializing in immigration. She is currently Director of Attorneys United for a Secure America. She has also been on various radio shows, guested in studio appearances, and probably more than I am not aware of. Today, we are going to talk about immigration, illegal immigration, the impact to America, and the impact on blue-collar professions. I'm not even sure myself where all this conversation will lead, but I'm pretty sure it will be interesting. Lorraine, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show.
Thank you, John.
Well, you are very welcome. So let's get started. Briefly explain, in a nutshell, what it is that you do.
I'm the director of Attorneys United for a Secure America. My job is to recruit attorneys across all 50 states to help out with stopping illegal immigration, which impacts all Americans' jobs, workers, and your wages.
Excellent. I found clips of both audio and video of you on YouTube. What are some of the places that you've recorded, presented regarding immigration and illegal immigration?
I'm traveling California, Oregon. I'm heading to Texas soon and the East Coast.
Awesome. Do you do a lot of podcasts or a lot of audio only recordings?
This will be my second podcast, but I've done a few video recordings. I've been on TV.
Okay. So this is a niche immigration. How did this particular topic of law resonate with you and become something that you find important?
Well, I immigrated legally, and so it impacted me. Seeing people sneak across the border and being rewarded for breaking the law.
So you immigrated here. How long ago did you immigrate to the United States?
I immigrated in the 1980s, but because of illegal immigration and that last amnesty, well, actually, there have been several amnesties, but in the 1986, it impacted me adversely because I had to wait several years. I had to continue paying and waiting for my citizenship as masses of illegal aliens were able to push in front.
Ouch. When you say paying, what does that entail? I'm not familiar with the whole process.
Oh, To become a legal immigrant, you need to first apply. There are processing fees, there's background checks, there's health checks, there's a whole bunch of checks to make certain that I would make a good addition to the United States. And so when my citizenship was delayed due to the amnesty, I had to reapply to continue staying in the United States legally because my citizenship had been delayed.
I see. And where is it that you immigrated from?
I immigrated from Canada.
Well, first off, welcome to America.
Thank you.
So what is the biggest problem that immigration is presenting in your viewpoint?
Well, there's quite a few problems, but I'd say one of the biggest problems, it impacts the wages of American workers.
How does that whole thing fall down? And I mean, feel free to elaborate on any of this that we're discussing, both illegal immigration and immigration. How do both of those impact the wages of Americans?
What happens is when you have, well, it's like an economics, supply and demand. So when you have more workers than available jobs, an employer can keep the wages down. Also, there's less jobs for Americans. And I can give a good example. Last August of 2019, the Kosh food distributors were raided by ICE. They removed 234 illegal aliens. And the very next day, Kosh food distributors had a job opening. And I heard there were hundreds of American workers seeking those same positions that they weren't able to get before.
I actually heard about that story myself on some of the other podcasts I've listened to. And there's a number of people that were not able to get jobs or were working much lower income jobs, and they were able to find employment there, and they are so excited about having that opportunity.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity. And when employers cheat by hiring and paying under the table, not only does that impact available jobs and the wages of Americans, but it also, they're not paying payroll taxes, which go towards the government, which goes back into the economy, and it just impacts everybody in all sorts of areas.
One of the things that you hear a lot is that if we don't let in illegal immigrants, who's going to pick our food? Who's going to pick our crops in the fields, and who's going to work the fields and bring in our produce? Obviously, those jobs do pay not a lot, but if we didn't have those illegal immigrants, who would do that work?
Well, first, an immigrant is not a connect term. A lot of people use it just because it's been changed to make it sound nice. But an illegal alien is someone who enters the country illegally without permission, or they overstay their visa. So they can't be illegal immigrant. They have to be illegal aliens. So who picks the foods? There's plenty of Americans out there who will do the work. And up until 1964-65, there was a Bracero program that worked out beautifully. Even Canada has a program like that. All they have to do is an employer, if they can't find American workers, they can go to South America or even Mexico. They give them health food checks to make certain that they're not carrying contagious diseases. They give you immunizations, make sure they're healthy enough to work. Then they bring the employees over for a specific time period, look after them, provide housing and food, and then send them home when the work is no longer needed. So they're not a burden on American taxpayers.
If we, first off, regarding the term illegal alien and illegal immigrant, I absolutely agree with you. Words mean things, and it is a way to try to shift the argument from illegal aliens to saying that you're anti-immigrant, which America is well known for over our past history of being very immigrant friendly. It may not be perfect. We can't let in everybody, but the United States lets in way more immigrants than most countries.
That's correct. We, in fact, admit over 1 million legal immigrants every year, and that's more than the rest of the world combined.
I was curious about benefits of legal immigration. Like, we have actual legal immigrants coming in. What's the benefits to America for this process?
So legal immigrants can be beneficial. there's always that opportunity for when they need temporary workers or they need skill sets that Americans don't have. I think in this world, we do have plenty of qualified Americans. So I do get a little bit concerned with the number of H-1B visa holders who come in from foreign countries, and they are actually also taking away work from Americans who can do those jobs. So there's a little bit of benefit, but there's also kind of a detriment to workers. And if you look at, I think it was like 1 year ago or so, where Disney hired a bunch of foreign workers and then had their employees train their replacements and then laid them off. So that part isn't correct. And that's not where we need. Now, if you have somebody who has specialized experience where it hasn't been gained or there aren't enough Americans, yes, I can see legal immigrants coming here.
I know that there was a particular situation, and I'm not going to give too many details, but I'm aware of a situation where there was somebody that was a legal immigrant. They were here in America legally. They were doing a, we'll call it a programming job. They were being paid a lot of money, which I found out accidentally. And there are already Americans that were capable of doing this, but the company had chosen to bring this person in and guaranteed that they would pay this person this much money. Why would a company do this?
There's a lot of reasons. Well, one of the main reasons are a lot of companies are work globally. So maybe there's some sort of benefit with the country in hiring foreign workers from their country. And so they may get like a beneficial contract in their country. Like I know China does that, where we hire Chinese and those same companies get benefits from the Chinese government and they're able to work out some massive deals because they've hired their own citizens.
I see. So you got to look a little deeper, and it's almost like, okay, I'll do this and this in exchange for this and this. The person who's coming here wins because they're getting paid really well, and they may not make that kind of salary in their own country.
That's correct.
But it's a detriment to, in this particular case, to American programmers, because, I mean, we're talking a six-figure income. And so this is a job that would have been done by an American absolutely for less than that, not significantly less, but I mean, this was really, really well paid considering the workload and the skill level required. I was just curious about that. I've always wondered what would be the benefit, because on the face of it, that didn't make a bit of sense. But with what you're explaining, that does make sense.
Right.
So what is your Go ahead. Absolutely.
I was just going to say that for a long time, a lot of these large companies will also get tax benefits in other countries. Now, I am seeing that there are benefits for this for our companies to be able to stay in the United States, hire American workers, and there's really not the need to be hiring as many foreign H-1B workers as they're currently doing. So I think the more people who find out that Americans are being bypassed for foreigners in exchange for a benefit for that company to do business in a foreign country, it is detrimental to Americans and really unfair.
That explains to some extent why you might see job postings that Americans do qualify for. And a lot of times these job postings will be specifically written so that they can hire the exact candidate that they're looking for. What about other than H-1B, what about more hands-on trades, which would be, in my opinion, blue collar, which is my hot button? I do hear that a lot, that Americans won't do the work, but I see that you put the opportunity out there. Americans are doing the work, even though we do have a lot of stigma associated nowadays because you're not going to college and you're doing something hands-on. I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place, but
Well, there's blue-collar workers that earn more than college students. So there really is no embarrassment or shame in being a blue-collar worker. In fact, my grandfather, even though he was from Wales, he was a blue-collar worker. So there's nothing wrong with the skill. But I do want to go back to the construction industry where illegal aliens are working. Well, first, a legal alien is not entitled to be working. And second, a lot of the times they're using somebody else's identity or social security cards. Yes. There was a case a few years ago where this woman who lived and worked in New York City was audited by the IRS because apparently she hadn't reported her earnings in California as being a construction worker. So it turned out an illegal alien had stolen her identity, was working in construction, filing taxes and claiming all these benefits and getting her refund check. And she was completely unaware of it. And she was telling the IRS, well, how on earth can I be working in New York and California at the same time when I have to be physically at my office in New York? And she had to hire a lawyer. She had to go through a lot of hassle. So when you see people working in construction or any of these blue-collar jobs, either they're using somebody's identity or the employer is paying them under the table, which means they're actually earning more than regular American employees. And let me explain how that works. Let's focus on somebody who's being paid under the table. Maybe they're making $30 an hour, but they're not having to pay taxes. They're not having to expend all the, lose their payroll taxes, the state tax, the federal tax, all these taxes. Whereas a blue collar worker who's being earned $30 an hour is getting all that money taken out of their paycheck. And in the meantime, this worker might have several identities. And so they're getting money from other sources, including public benefits. So it's really a big scam on the American worker.
That also benefits the employer because they don't have to pay the additional, the other half of the Social Security.
Exactly.
Let's just say somebody's presenting, here's my credentials, my American identification. Does the employer, are they able to just verify that Social Security number, or are they allowed to even do an analysis to make sure that that person meets all the necessary identity? I guess what I'm asking is they have to double check. They have to verify according to the law, and I forget what that was called, but it's
an I-9 form that they have to fill out and provide identity, you know, driver's license and other proofs of who you are. But I think some of it does allow for fraud. And if you look at California and a few other states who are giving illegal aliens driver's licenses, we're finding that there's nothing on the driver's license to indicate that they're legally here. Now, I do know the real ID is supposed to stop some of that, but I am worried about maybe a dishonest government worker just going ahead and looking the other way as they hand them a real ID. So I am worried about that. But for the most part, employers are supposed to be checking. There needs to be more auditing of employers to be checking all the I-9s. And a lot of times, employers are finding out they're not being audited and they're not being checked. So they see this as an opportunity to cheat until they get caught and then maybe just pay a fine. And they figure maybe they're ahead by cheating the system and depriving American workers of decent wages and jobs.
I think that there's a huge number of people that think it's okay. And here's why I say this. Look at all of the legal outsourcing, all the availability to hire people like on Fiverr, and very, very economically priced because you are hiring workers where the exchange rate makes it very cheap to hire these people. And they could hire an American to do this work for $20-$30 an hour, say in graphic design, anything electronic where it requires a computer. But they're hiring people and they're paying them $4, $5, $6, $8 an hour, and they're getting great work, but they are shortchanging American workers. And you have this happen where even the average person, let's say you have somebody that's just going to start a business and they're just a regular person like like you or I, they'll be happy to go on Fiverr and get something cheap as well, but they still want their stuff to be sold in America, and they want people to think of America first when it comes to them, but everybody's willing to look the other way for themselves to go find cheaper labor regardless of where it is.
That's true, and unless there's accountability and people watching employers reporting them and demanding that there's changes, it's going to be really hard to get this done, and I think it's the public responsibility to put pressure on the government. And if there's enough pressure, the governments will start doing more auditing and being a little more efficient and careful in their work. Years ago, I worked for the government, and I noticed that when the public held them accountable, we actually got things done, and our bosses would say, okay, we have to be extra careful because we have the public watching this area. And so I kind of thought it was, shouldn't we be doing this anyways? And
absolutely.
Unfortunately, they're just not, unless they're being held accountable.
If they're worried about being extra careful because they're being watched, it seems to me that there's a political component. Did any of these people have a particular way that they were trying to skew the system because of their political outlook?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I've seen a lot of companies will just pay off all politicians regardless of their political background. And it's awful. I don't mean to be laughing. It's not funny, but it's frustrating because you look at it, for example, if money talks. So if there's like a certain, say you have $30 and everyone has to contribute a dollar, but the government and these employers know that there's going to be three people who are going to get this contract. And so they're going to get a chance of getting $10 each. Well, the regular people who put in a dollar don't have as much influence and power over the government, but the three companies know that if they spend $9, they're going to get $10. They're going to get their dollar back, and they get opportunities that aren't available to the regular people. And so this is where we get into the subject of special interests and how they're able to sway politicians. And this is what I see as part of the frustration. But, you know, our founders actually set up this country in a really good way, much better than the rest of the world. How it's supposed to be is that government's supposed to be limited. And when we allow government to get too big, we're allowing more of these special interests and these behind-the-scenes back deals that Americans don't qualify for. And then you keep wondering, how are these big companies getting away with it? And that's part of because Americans haven't been holding their government accountable. They haven't been demanding that government be limited and constrained. I mean, it's our duty to hold them accountable. And when we don't do that, we're seeing the results of this.
And for clarity, the only government that is limited and constrained is the federal government. The state government has much more leeway to be very onerous. And as long as they're not doing anything outside what the Constitution specifically prohibits the state to do, the state could be very authoritarian and draconian as long as they're not violating any of the federal mandates that they can't violate. And that was the intent, because the founders wanted the states to be an experiment where states would compete with each other. But the federal government itself was supposed to be very, very, very hands-off and limited.
Right. But there are constitutions for each of the 50 states. They all have a constitution. And I've noticed, like, for example, California, a lot of times the politicians will just exceed the authority of the California Constitution. Or you look at the New York Constitution and the Massachusetts Constitution. A lot of times the citizens within those states are not holding their own state governments accountable to the constitution in which they're supposed to be operating. So you'll see them exceeding what they're supposed to be doing. But unfortunately, we've got a mindset now where people are thinking, oh, the government makes the decisions. We have no power. And that's not how it's supposed to be. The American people do have power, and you just need to be exercising your power. The other problem is elections. We need to have free and fair elections. And you know, I come from Canada and we have voter ID. We've never had a problem. Mexico has voter ID. Most of the world has voter ID and they have a lot less voter fraud than the United States does. And it's such a shame. I mean, we could even go back to the 1850s where there was a lot of voter fraud. And I kind of wish that there had been an amendment where they had required ID back in the 1800s. So we wouldn't be talking about it now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When you think about it, you have this nostalgic feeling about how things would have been way back in the day. But when you start looking at the history, you're like, man, things were just as wild and chaotic just for different things back then as well. It's been a constant erosion of personal power. Everything keeps shifting to the federal government, little by little by little.
Right. And that's where Americans have failed in holding their government accountable. I think people just assumed, oh, we've got government and there's checks and balances. Well, they forget that they are the checks and balances of government. And people need to be educated as to what this government, how it was formed, and what the limitations that government has. I mean, you think about the government like teenagers. If you don't control your teenagers, they're going to be out of control. And that's what we've got right now with our federal and some of our state governments.
Right. So there's a lot of things going on with immigration, with illegal aliens. Tell me something else that might be interesting to us about immigration and how it affects blue-collar workers.
Last month in December 2019, our House of Representatives passed the Farm Workers Bill, which is really an amnesty. Now, this is great for big ag special interests, as I was talking about. It's also great for politicians. But unfortunately, Americans are going to get harmed, and we're going to be required to foot the bill. This is how it works. It's an amnesty because all a migrant has to do, or an illegal alien, is say, oh, yes, I worked on a farm for X amount of days. There's no verification that that's true. And then they come in and then the government says, okay, will you work that period of time? All right, we'll go ahead and process you and give you amnesty. Well, what happens is the individual who may or may not have worked on a farm suddenly leaves the farm and they go off and they get other jobs and they're competing with other Americans for the same jobs. Well, what happens then is the farms are now needing more workers. So then they bring in more illegal aliens, pay them under the table.
It's like a funnel.
Do the whole thing. Yeah, it just goes on and on. You know, when I think of Americans, I think of all Americans because this even harms, you know, women and minorities and a bunch of people who are earning low or poor working conditions. Whereas, you know, Americans are now unfortunately getting the scraps where it should be kind of the other way around. If you're an illegal alien, you shouldn't be working and you shouldn't be getting any kind of benefit. You need to be playing by the rules. And that's part of human nature. So, you know, 1986, and we can go back there, we were supposed to admit about 1.4 million illegal aliens and make them citizens. And that was supposed to be it. No more amnesty, what have you. Unfortunately, what happened was the border got stormed. I mean, I was sitting there waiting for my citizenship. I had a number of illegal aliens show up, and then they knew I could read and write Spanish and speak Spanish. So they would ask me, oh, could you fill out my application for me? And I was like, well, how can you do that? Well, you just came here literally 1 week ago. You're supposed to have been here illegally for 8 years. And then they said to me, and this is might make some people mad. They said, oh, well, all we have to do is go to the Catholic Church. And at the Catholic Church, the nuns will give us a name and a phone number to call. We make a donation to the church. We call this person. We give them $200 and they give us all the fake IDs, the fake utility bills, fake employment stubs, the whole works. And then they go fraudulently apply for their citizenship. And this was done by the millions. And it wasn't just the 1.4 that we were promised. We were also promised to get the the wall built back then. And here we are. Americans have been more than patient, and we've seen the devastation.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. So when we talk about anyone can claim that they worked on a farm for X number of days to qualify, we have terrorists coming across the border. We have gang members. They have no intention of working. In fact, if they do, they do it undercover. So they're taking away money from the American worker, but they're also committing massive crimes. And we don't have a shortage of Americans who are already committing crimes. So we don't need to import more criminals. We don't need to import terrorists. Actually, we don't want terrorists, period. And we don't need to import people who basically have low education skills and maybe a culture where they don't care about education. They don't care about contributing to society. And they all become burdens on the American people. So as I said earlier in your show, you have a lot of Americans seeking work, and many of them are not working to the salary that they should be earning and they deserve. And so now their tax money is going towards paying illegal aliens. As you know, look at California. They want to raise our taxes again. I think us and New York have the highest taxes in the nation, and we get the worst services, the worst roads, the worst infrastructure, and some of the highest homeless. And I've actually walked to areas, Los Angeles, to meet the homeless, and I've spoken to them, and I don't see any illegal aliens there. They're American citizens who are homeless. So you're thinking, well, where on earth are the legal aliens living? They're living in Section 8 housing provided for complements of the American taxpayer. So what happens with that? Rents become more expensive, making it even harder for a regular family to even buy a home, let alone rent. And Americans are suffering. So I don't see any benefit for having illegal aliens. And I believe we should be limiting the number of legal immigrants to this country. We need to be able to get a hold of what's going on right now before we even start thinking about bringing in more people. When you look at our roads, our highways, it's just congestion everywhere. And the housing is just, I mean, it's great for construction, but the problem is you've got people who don't belong here. You wouldn't need to be doing construction. And no, there is no fear of not having work. There is plenty of work, even without the illegal aliens, and there'd be plenty of work in construction. There's always needs to rebuild, redo, or even build new buildings and offices for Americans, not for the illegals.
When you mentioned the Section 8 housing, is that something that is legally allowed to illegal immigrants or just legal immigrants or American citizens, all three? I mean, if an illegal alien comes in and applies for Section 8 housing and we know that they're an illegal, are they able to qualify for that?
They're not supposed to. And of course, you know, our government has been telling us basically mistruths or lies and saying, oh, no, no, we don't allow illegal aliens to use public services or Section 8 housing. And yet we're finding there's several illegal aliens living in housing. I mean, one of the other ways they do it is through the anchor baby system. But if you have a dishonest government worker and they just pass on the paperwork because they decide they want to be altruistic with taxpayer money, they're going to go ahead and give housing to the illegal alien. Mm-hmm. So how this works is a number of the homeless I spoke to said Section 8 or the housing authority would raise their rents, and they were already low income and they could no longer afford rent. So they'd go to housing authority and say, can I be moved into somewhere more affordable. And what housing authority would do is give them a brand new tent and say, go find your new home. And the benefit of putting an illegal alien in the housing is they're not paying rent. It's the taxpayers who are paying rent for the illegal alien. And so if you've noticed, if you see where there's homeless people, you'll see a lot of really nice looking tents. They didn't go to some big store and buy a tent. It was given to them by our American government. I mean, I've seen it in DC, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Some of them don't have tents, but if they did, they'd be really nice looking. Mm-hmm. And so this is really a shame, and it's a crime against Americans.
Absolutely. So we have somebody that comes in and they're an immigrant. They are legal. They are not an American citizen. Would that particular person qualify for Section 8 housing?
Technically, no. They're not supposed to be. For example, if you use me, when I came here, I had to show that I was 16 when I came here. I had to show that I could pay for myself and that I would not be a burden and I would not have to, I would not try to apply for a public benefit. Plus, since the 1640s, even before this became United States of America, we had public charge rules where people could not become a burden on your neighbor. And I don't see how Americans can afford to pay for people who shouldn't be here in the first place. Or even if you're here legally, you're supposed to be able to prove that you can care for yourself, mm-hmm. that you can provide for your own housing, you can afford to pay for your own food and everything else that you need and not be a burden on taxpayers. And what recently has happened with the public charge rule, it's now being enforced by the current Trump administration.
Enforcing
that you have to be able to pay for yourself. And if you do apply, you're not going to be allowed to become a U.S. citizen.
I had heard something about this, and I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, it is good. It's going to help Americans.
And I'd like to take a little side tangent to, you said since the 1640s, we had the public charge. What'd you call that again?
It was a public charge rule. What was in the 1640s, we had colonists who were moving here and working for England, but the requirement was they needed to be able-bodied and build their own homes, provide their own food, and basically look after themselves while they were working for England. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't be a burden. And of course, the theory was, how can you expect poor people to be working, providing for their own families, and then having to pay for their neighbors who are sitting around not doing anything? You can't have that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at even the founding with the, I believe it was William Bradford, he had an experiment where people came and he said, hey, we're going to do our first example of socialism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Everyone's going to get a piece of land. And then at the end of the season, you're going to put everything that you've produced put into a big pile and we'll divide it up equally. Well, after a couple of years, they realized there were several people who weren't contributing to the pile. Instead, they were having fun knowing that their neighbor's going to be working. And so after that, the decision was like, okay, no more socialism. Mm-hmm. What we're going to do is the land's going to be divided up. What you produce on your land, you can keep some of it and you can sell the surplus. Mm-hmm. And if you don't provide for yourself, then you can't expect your neighbors to give to you.
And production shot up like crazy.
Yes, it did.
I feel the same way about team concepts like at work. Like, okay, you know, all eight people are going to contribute. And it's going to be a team project, and nobody is recognized individually for their efforts. I do not like that at all. I want to be recognized for what I do. I want to be, whether it's good or bad, because inevitably, I have never seen it to be otherwise. You're always going to have somebody slacking off. And if you complain about that, it always turns into a situation where, yeah, that's okay. I mean, you know, you're a team, work it out. And you get turned into this homogenous group and you are limited into recognition for your achievements, advancement, whatever it might be. And it's the same way with you hear about like family farms that start getting divided and they're worked together. It always turns into arguments and disagreements because one person wants to do this, one person wants to do that. They make the money. They don't feel like that family is contributing. And a lot of times that family is not contributing because, man, there are slackers everywhere.
there are, if we don't need to import more slackers. Yeah, I mean, even you look at with kids, when the teacher says, okay, we're going to do a group project, you'll see one of the kids will just sit out or be very lazy about it, and it'll frustrate the other kids in the group. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice if they had like a self-report card where they could say, well, hey, Johnny did a great job, but Susie, you know, she just played cards or played on her iPhone while everyone else did the work. You know, Johnny really pulled up, was a great team leader and made sure everything happened. And Susie needs to make a job. I mean, when you start out noticing and pointing out to people who are not pulling their fair share, you'll notice that people do make a difference. Mm-hmm. Now, the way I went to school is the teacher would call out the test results for a test. And so you're always hoped, you're like, oh, can I be the first? Or, oh, okay. And you get kind of nervous if you're not there like halfway through. Mm-hmm. And when it starts getting to the end, you start getting the stare. And I remember some of my classmates who got very uncomfortable when the other classmates looked at them and they got a very low score on their test. And you'll notice like the next test is like, uh-oh, you know, they're going to move up and they're going to really jockey to get themselves to the top grade, because it's not a group effort. It is a group effort, but it's also, there's going to be accountability and consequences.
I don't know if you could do that today, because it would be considered public shaming, and that's not, you know, that's going to be good for their self-esteem, that kind of thing.
Well, your self-esteem isn't going to put food on the table.
No, it's not.
It's also not going to help you get out of bed in the morning. It's not going to give you, I mean, human nature likes competition. Mm-hmm. I mean, competition is really good. It's healthy, and you can learn from winning. You can also learn from losing. If you lose at something, you know, you're going to have to try harder or try a different technique, and you're going to improving yourself. You're going to be, what is it? You're going to start becoming very creative and very skilled. And it's kind of exciting when you see a lot of depressed kids nowadays. I'm thinking, you know, they're not being challenged, and challenge is competition and trying to be the best that you can possibly be. In fact, I think, wasn't that the old Army's logo? Be the best you can be. And
maybe be all you can be.
Oh, be all you can be. Well, be all you can be. Be the best. Excel. You know, moving yourself. And I think in the olden days, they should have it now. They used to have apprentices. Mm-hmm. So you'd be an apprentice in a worker shop, and you'd be working and learning the skill and the craft. And it was a chance for you to develop and learn your skills and get better. You'd receive some criticisms and ways you can improve, and you work and you're basically improving your skill, and you become a better craftsman, or, you know, whatever skill that you're working in. And so I think, you know, part of that is part of competition. It's part of being challenged. And I think it really would make a difference in people's psyche, and not so many depressed people out there now.
I think they still do have a lot of apprenticeships. Like if you're going to be a plumber, you start out as an apprentice, and then you work up your way up to maybe a journeyman, and then a licensed plumber. But you start out as an apprentice, and you're kind of like a glorified gopher, but they'll let you do this. They'll oversee you while maybe you cut a piece of pipe and you finish it out to connect, but you have somebody watching you while you do that particular aspect. And there's a lot of apprenticeships also, even say software, where you can wind up having somebody that you're going to work with. A lot of companies, though, don't want to undertake people and train them. They want their workers to show up already ready to go.
Right. And, you know, that's a problem. I mean, you look at a lot of the attitude of our millennials and our younger people, and some of them, they show up and then 2 weeks later they've left after the company's trained them. And I can see that for a company, but I think we need to start bringing back some pride, you know, pride of ownership, you know, learning to communicate and being committed to your job. Give your job 6 months to a year before you even think about looking around if it's not working out. But if it's working out, excel yourself and do really well. And so I think that's part of what a lot of employers are seeing, is the attitude of the youngsters who don't value work and they think, oh, I can just go somewhere else. And that doesn't benefit the employer. And it really doesn't benefit the employee. Because if you start changing jobs a lot, maybe there's something about that employee.
Well, I think there's some truth to that as far as changing jobs. I do know that a lot of times the way to get ahead nowadays is you're not going to get a raise where you're at or anything more than nominal, but you go to another company and you can get a nice little bump. And the company that wasn't able to pay you that nominal, pay you a regular raise or a nice raise, is now forced to pay even more to get somebody new to come in the door. But they don't want to give the average employees nice raises, even if the market value dictates that, because most employees are just going to stay. I think it winds up being cheaper for them not to give those raises. But when it comes to millennials, I'm not quite as down on the millennials as everybody seems to be, because I think there's some truth to the fact that companies are notorious about treating employees badly, especially long term. There's no security. They are just trying to get employees as cheap as possible. And the millennials know this, and they're like, no, I think you're going to have to pay me a little bit more. I hear this sometimes where people talk about, I can't find people that will work. And then you find out what they're wanting to pay. And they think that going from, say, $18 an hour to $20 an hour is this big raise. Whereas, why don't they pop out 30, 35? Technically, they might be able to do this, but they don't feel that the employee is worth that kind of money. But the market forces is what dictates what somebody's value is. And if they can't find somebody at 18, but they can at 30, well, then it looks like $30 is the price point. And a lot of companies are just not willing to pay that money. And the millennials are like, no, I'm not willing to do it for cheap. They saw what happened to their fathers and their mothers, and they're not going to let that happen to them.
Yeah, I agree partly with you on that, but I think part of it is people are not negotiating their wages well enough. And the other problem is the minimum wage. And maybe this is a hot button that I shouldn't be touching, but beg your pardon?
I said anything is on the table. Talk about whatever you want.
Okay. Well, I actually disagree with raising the minimum wage. One, it makes paying people money that they're really not worth. So if you're having to pay someone $15 an hour to work at a fast food restaurant, it may be cheaper to go to computers or robots. And
we're seeing that
because they're not going to need workers' comp and all these problems. Mm-hmm. But you're also going to get the same quality work for the machine instead of the employee. So that causes a problem because now all of a sudden there's more people out of work in the marketplace. And by having a minimum wage of $15 an hour, all of a sudden employers and companies are going to have to raise the costs of their services and products, which makes it more expensive. So anyone who thinks now I'm earning $15 an hour, they've just basically undermine themselves because that's not extra money because they've just basically, you're having to pay more money for this, for the same thing because everything's become more expensive. So my personal opinion is there should be no minimum wage. That would help.
Exactly. That was going to be my point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad somebody finally agrees with me.
Zero minimum wage. If that person's not worth but a dollar an hour, that's what they make.
Right. And that would reduce the cost of products. It also makes people more competitive and more willing to negotiate their wage. Well, okay, so you think you're worth $15 an hour? Well, show me and prove it to me. If you're not, I'm going to go hire somebody for $10 an hour who's going to be worth that $10 an hour. And so that's where you need to be able to get into negotiation skills. And I wish they'd teach that to kids in high school. It's like, teach them how to negotiate. I mean, everything I would say is pretty much on the market can be negotiated. I negotiated my rent when I was in college, and I was so surprised by my neighbors just paying the rent that was being asked. And I think I paid 50% of one of my next door neighbors paid for their apartments because they didn't even think about negotiating the amount. And you can do this when you go buy a car, when you, you go, actually you can go when you go to a store and say, well, you know, this is too much. can you get me a deal or do you have a coupon? You know, what can we do to get this price down? I think it's a bit too much. I'm not willing to buy it right now, but I'll buy it so you get a sale if we can negotiate the price. I did that with a dishwasher 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was on sale for $1,200. I got it negotiated down for $500.
That is a hell of a deal.
Yeah, it was a great deal.
Well, speaking of the minimum wage, if there is no minimum wage and you have somebody that comes in and they're willing to work for $6 an hour, and the next day somebody else comes in and you need somebody and that person says, I won't accept less than 12. And you say, well, what skills do you have? Turns out they're really good with people, blah, blah, blah. You see them as possible management material and you hire them as $12 an hour and they are working side by side with that other guy doing the fryer. It's fair. I do not think that the federal government should be involved in babysitting people's choices when it comes to wages.
Right. And you know, that's another reason not to talk about your salary, because you might be earning more. You might be earning actually, if you're earning less, you probably might figure, okay, what do I need to do to improve myself so I can earn $12 instead of the $6?
Right. And convention is typically that you don't talk about your salary. I don't care if people talk about the salary or not, as long as there's no federal mandate against it. I'm very, very, very big on the federal government being restricted by the Constitution. The Constitution is a document designed to restrict the federal government, not so much allow the federal government. And all rights not specifically given to the federal government resides with the states. And then, of course, we're back to what does each state constitution say, like you had pointed out. This whole aspect of wages, salary, immigration. Immigration. This is an area that the federal government is charged with. And if we go look at the Constitution, what is the government responsible for to do and not do? And that's really where we need to key in, because the federal government is not living up to what they are charged to do according to the Constitution.
That's right. And that's why I think in a way it would be nice if we paid less to the government and make them work for more. Because right now when they tax citizens, we're having to do more for less money. But so actually the nice thing about the United States Constitution is that it was written to protect the citizens against the government. And mm-hmm. The United States Constitution is the only one in the world that actually is set up that way. Now, England has a constitution, but it's basically the government that decides which rights citizens yes. get. And when a government gives rights, they can take rights away. That's right. Well, in Canada, I was excited at first, and then I realized after I read the Canadian Constitution, it's actually written for the benefit of the government. So it's kind of like a little bait and switch with the public, and they think, oh, we've got a constitution. Well, yes, but now you're a servant of the government. Mm-hmm. And with the United States government, that's why I keep saying, and the American people need to hold their government accountable. You need to hold your state government accountable. You need to hold your federal government accountable. You need to hold every level of government, including your local governments, accountable, and let them know that they work for you, not the other way around. And when you see some of these laws coming out from the federal government or the state governments, you're thinking, gee, they've forgotten who's in charge. Mm-hmm. And Americans need to stand up and say, okay, nope, you're not doing that. And when we talk about immigration, yeah, that is a federal issue. The American government is supposed to be protecting our boundaries, our American sovereignty, protecting the citizens, not protecting illegal aliens. And you look at these sanctuary cities where yes. they're more concerned about protecting illegal aliens and gang members and rapists and all sorts of horrible people. And American citizens have no protection and they get called names. It's like, no, that's not how it's supposed to work. And Americans need to realize that the government works for you. And when I worked for government, I was very proud to be able to find ways to help the public, because I felt very strongly that the public is paying for a service and they better get something and they better see results. And so it was very frustrating. So that's why I left working for government, because I got tired of the, you know, the backdoor deals with companies or private citizens to get things that other people didn't get. And that's not how government's supposed to do it. It's supposed to be representing the American people and the citizens.
So if we were able to, let's just hypothetically say, eliminate illegal aliens, not legal immigration, but eliminate the whole problem of illegal aliens. Let's just say we could do that tomorrow. What would be the impact that you would see from that?
Well, hypothetically, because yes. You can't 100% exactly. Solve the problem, but you can get really close to it. If immigration was finally enforced, we made the illegal aliens go home to their country of origin and apply legally like everyone else in the world does, what you would find is less congested roads, less car accidents, crime would go down, there'd be more housing for Americans, there'd be more jobs, and Americans would have better control over their wages and the jobs that they can choose. And employers would have to be a lot nicer to their employees because they know that there's a lot of jobs that they need filled. And if they want those jobs filled and their employees to stay, that they better pay them well and treat them well.
With the aspect of how the employers are treating the employees, I think that right now we're seeing a little bit of that where the employers are treating the employees better simply because supply and demand, and they know they can't just kick them out the door and go grab somebody else. They're having to, and I'm a little bit mixed on some of the information that I'm getting. Sometimes it seems like we really do have a shortage, and sometimes it seems like there's just a lot of other influences and factors making it feel that way. But long story short, a lot of people are having a hard time finding workers to cover a lot of the jobs that are out there.
I think we have too many Americans using public services themselves. I mean, when I go to the store, I see people with their EBT cards, and I'm thinking, she looks really healthy. He looks really healthy. Why is he not working? I mean, there's a lot of jobs with a variety of different skill sets. Not all jobs are physical. Not all jobs require lots of thinking or lots of super skills. But you see a lot of people just sitting home and waiting for their next welfare check. And there needs to be some accountability in that respect. So that's where we need to get the government back and say, look, employers need jobs filled. And we have a lot of Americans who actually aren't working because they're on public benefits. So one, we need to have drug testing for public benefits. If you're on drugs, you're not getting your public benefits. And if you're able-bodied, you should be able to get a job. There's part-time work. There's full-time work. You can do this. And we also need to, rein in some of the workers' comp laws. I did workers' comp law on both sides, not only for the applicant, but also for employers and for insurance companies. And, there's a bit of problems on all ends, but we need to be able to make it a little harder to get workers' comp, so it can't be like a backfall. In fact, if we go back to illegal aliens, one of my first workers' comp job, I didn't realize there was a seating area for attorneys. So I went and sat amongst the regular people waiting for their hearing. And I was sitting next to a couple of guys who were speaking in Spanish. Well, I understand Spanish. And they were hoping that their hearing would go quick so they could get permanent disability. But they needed to get out of here quickly because they had another job they were going to. It was like, how could you be getting, workers' compensation for full disability when you're able-bodied and you're going to get your next job and maybe you're using somebody else's identity? Mm-hmm. And a lot of illegal aliens have several identities. So that's a problem. So there needs to be a lot more accountability. Get people off public benefits and those jobs will be filled.
So in your time as an attorney, you've seen all these stories. What led you to, you've talked about the fact that you had saw the difficulty getting your own citizenship, but day in and day out, you're working as an attorney. You've worked for, looks like, two different organizations at least. You have a team of attorneys that you work with. What is the goal and the overall objective that you guys are working towards every day?
Well, we're working towards protecting Americans. We've got a government that's out of control. We look at these government states and counties and jurisdictions that want to protect illegal aliens instead of their own citizens. And so that's part of our job, is to be able to hold American government accountable, hold the federal government, the state, local governments accountable so that Americans are protected. When we see all sorts of crimes being committed by illegal aliens, and we'll write amicus briefs for the Board of Immigration Appeals. And I'm looking at some of these cases and I'm thinking, wow, you know, they get another appeal. They're using government paid lawyers to represent the illegal alien. And we're just a nonprofit organization trying to defend the American people and say, look, this person did such and such a crime. That's an aggravated felony. They need to be out of this country. We wouldn't allow people to legally come into this country having committed those same crimes in their own country. Why are we allowing people to stay after they've committed these crimes and go through all these multiple appeals? I mean, they seem to get more rights than Americans. And that's what really frosts me, because I'm on the side of American workers. I'm on the side of Americans. I want safety. I want jobs for Americans. I want great wages for Americans. I don't mind paying more, as long as when we're paying more, it's because it's for Americans and American jobs. I don't want to be paying more taxes like we are in California to benefit illegal aliens. So let me sidetrack. I did taxes for a couple of years. And yeah, I did see the H-1B visas, but I also noticed, you know, the difference in the wage salaries for Americans and H-1B visas. Then I noticed there was, a group of illegal aliens who would have their anchor baby, who would have their Social Security number, and they'd be getting, you know, rebates back from them. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, you know, we're not helping the American people. And then you look, you see illegal aliens who have health insurance, and you look at Americans who are having to use their own wages to pay for their own health insurance, or they're getting limited health services because our hospitals or our doctor's offices are clogged with illegal aliens getting services that actually belong to the American people. So it's a problem all around to be benefiting illegal aliens. And that's what we're doing at the Immigration Reform Law Institute. And my organization is related to the Immigration Reform Law Institute by recruiting attorneys across all 50 states. There's a lot of work to be done. We need attorneys to help us out with some cases or to appear in counsel, because we're not licensed to practice in all 50 states. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done. The other side that wants open borders, you know, oh, bring them in, give them all the benefits, give them the jobs that Americans, wink, wink, won't do, but they will do. We're fighting against an army of 16,000 attorneys. So I need to recruit as many attorneys as I can in every state. And I'm happy to say that I was in Oregon a couple of weeks ago, and I had a number of attorneys sign up. So the more attorneys hear about me on the radio, or the more people who hear that, you know, this is a really popular stance, I mean, to protect Americans.
Absolutely.
They are recruiting attorneys for us, and that's really helpful. And I also have California attorneys who are now signing up. I have attorneys who I'm hoping to see in Texas soon who are going to sign up. I need them to sign up in all 50 states. We don't have attorneys right now in all 50 states, but we do need them, because you never know when the next case is going to happen, when we need an attorney to appear, or we need assistance with research or writing a brief or even part of a brief. So everything that we can do to recruit as many attorneys is going to benefit Americans.
That's awesome. Now, do you survive on donations? How does all that work?
We do a lot of grant funding. We survive on donations. A lot of my time I do without pay, and I also get paid, but it's you know, there's not a lot of money. I mean, I consider this to be a worthwhile career move to be able to help people. And so I don't mind taking a pay cut to work here because I really love what I'm doing. I'm so happy to meet so many wonderful Americans, and we really need to help Americans. And I will feel that's my payment, is seeing Americans' lives improve, mm-hmm. you know, and my salary helps too, but, but otherwise making a difference and protecting Americans and American workers, Americans' wages, protecting our health and our safety, you know, stopping all these criminals. As I said before, we have enough criminals. We don't need some more. So that's why I'm here. And that's why I'm trying to recruit as many attorneys as possible. And we'll even take law students to help us do some legal research. So anything helps.
Sure. Now, when you take on a case or you take on an action, does that always have to be in defense of somebody that has been wronged, or are you able to go after a particular law without actually having a situation that happened? I know what you're trying to fight for, and I'm just curious, how do you push back against that?
Okay, what we do is we have to pick something that's of a national interest, because we have hundreds of cases we could be handling, but we don't have enough attorneys. We don't have enough volunteer attorneys. So what we do is we look at national impact. For example, we're currently working on the public charge rule. We're working on birthright citizenship issues. We're working on cases at the Board of Immigration Appeals for seeing that illegal aliens and legal immigrants are being removed out of this country who have been harming Americans, either by committing crimes, you know, theft or fraud, embezzlement, a whole bunch of different crimes. Those should be automatic removals from the country. We're working on issues. We have a case down in Texas where this illegal alien in a detention center, the thing about the detention center is, you can leave the detention center. So it's not a concentration camp. If you want to leave, you can go back to your country of choice and wait for your hearing. But a lot of people choose to stay in the detention center. So the case that's going on right now is this woman, she's an illegal alien, and the detention center says to all the people that stay at the detention center, okay, you have to make your bed in the morning and you have to clean the bathroom after you've used it. That's all she has to do, clean up after yourself. Mm-hmm. And so she's suing because she believes she's entitled to maid service or housekeeping. And so she thinks the American taxpayer should be paying for her housekeeper. And here she is illegally, and she could easily go home if she doesn't like it that she has to make her own bed. I mean, I think most Americans make their own beds and they don't wait for a housekeeper to do it for them.
Well, I have two housekeepers.
You have two housekeepers. Wow.
That's awesome. I'm just kidding, of course.
Oh, I am the housekeeper in my house. And so are, you know, my kids. So we have to clean up after ourselves. We have to make our own beds.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's one of the cases. Then there's another case up in Massachusetts and then Washington State where they don't want ICE to go to the courthouse. And as a practicing attorney, I've had clients who are American citizens who were detained inside a courthouse. I had a couple of my clients hadn't paid all of their child support. They paid some of it, but not all of it. And so the court basically got the bailiff to go ahead and detain them, put them in handcuffs, and take them to jail at the end of the hearing. And I can think if Americans can be detained, I mean, we have Americans who go to prison every day and they get separated from their families. And so I think illegal aliens should be detained at a courthouse if ICE needs to detain them. It could be Massachusetts, Washington State, or any of the 50 states. There shouldn't be special protections for illegal aliens that aren't available for American citizens.
Right. Lorraine, it sounds like you're doing some really good, important work. I think it's a freaking hot button for me as well, as far as the illegal immigrants. I'm happy to have people that have paid their dues, been qualified, and are here and are contributing, and basically happy to have them, although I don't want to be inundated because I'm very much an American first, America first, every single time type person. The things that you're talking about are important to fight against. We got to push back against the federal government. You're doing some good work. I hear your call for more attorneys to help. What are some good ways for these people, that these attorneys that might want to help you? What would you like to see? How would you like them to contact you?
Oh, perfect. We have a web, we have two websites. Let me give them both to you. The first one is www.ausamerica.org. So ausamerica.org. And that you can just click on join and you can apply. And we do a background check to make sure you're not working for the other side. And then you're in. The other website is www.irli.org. And that stands for the Immigration Reform Law Institute. So IRLI.org. And on that website, they have lots of really good information. They have cases that we've been working on that we've finished. A lot of our audio and TV appearances are also on there. We all even have a Bling store. So if you'd like to buy some products, you can. We sell Build the Wall mugs. We have all
That's
sorts
awesome.
Of different. Thank you, pardon?
I said that is awesome.
Yeah, we do. We have Build the Wall. Yeah, so it's a nice black mug. And as soon as you put some hot coffee in there, it's on one side, it says Build the Wall. The other side, it says Make It Tall. So it's a great mug. And we've had to do several remakes of the mug because it is so popular. We've sold tens of thousands of these mugs. So if you want to be part of the in crowd, go ahead and buy one of our mugs. It's great. They'll ship it to you and it'll come in a beautiful package and you'll have your own Build the Wall mug. And I think it's perfect for blue collar workers because that's, you know, we're doing that for you.
That's outstanding. Lorraine, it has been great having you on the show today and talking about the things you're doing to help improve America. And of course, not only blue collar, but also software developers, anybody that works in America that finds their job being threatened by immigration that shouldn't be taking place or illegal aliens. We need to do whatever we can to make America strong and the best that we can be. I wish you great success. And just before we go, is there anything else that you'd like to say that you have not yet said?
Oh boy, I've said a lot. But thank you, John, for having me. This is really great. Please, if you're not an attorney, and I bet you know one, encourage them to join us because this is the right side to be on, being pro-America and for America, because this is what this country's about. And this is what makes this country great is Americans. Without Americans, this wouldn't be a great country. So it is a great country because we have all these wonderful Americans. So thank you. Thank you for letting me talk on your show.
Well, thank you for coming on. Lorraine, have a great day. I wish you great success and I hope this helps and I will talk to you later.
Thank you, John.
Hey guys, before you go, two things. The first is, I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show. Basically, I'm looking for those that excel in the blue collar arena and have actually got their hands dirty, truly understanding what it is like to do the work. Now the second thing, and exciting, hey, at least for me, I am planning a road trip. Phase one is building a list of locations to visit. Some locations will be just a meet and greet. Others will be on-site audio and or video. Please check out the website for more information. I'd love to hear from you. Email me at johnc@bluecollarvoices.com. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. Thanks all. Looking forward to hearing from you. Blue Collar Voices is produced by John Chapman, and all audio, video, graphics are created and edited by John Chapman. Blue Collar Voices is a DR7 Media production.
I'll be back.